for joining us tonight, and welcome to The Wine Muse. The Wine Muse is live every third Thursday of the month here on BTR. I'm your host, Linda Rez, and I'm here with my co-host, William Pollard, from Wild for Washington Wine, and we would like to invite you to join us by calling in tonight and telling us where you're at and what you're drinking. And welcome to the Wine Muse. This is Linda Rez here, and I'm with my co-host William Pollard, as the intro just said, from Wild for Washington Wine. And our topic tonight is one that's been in the headlines a lot lately, so we wanted to talk about it and see if it's something we should be worried about. It's the arsenic in wine lawsuit that's been kind of plastered all over the place, and certain wines have been implicated in it. And so we want to talk about that tonight. Get your thoughts if you want to call in, 909-202-8606. But William's here. I've got a few things, too. William's here with all the facts, and he's going to kind of cut through the BS here. Welcome to the show, William.
Oh, thanks, Linda. How are you today?
Good, good, good. And you're going to be talking about the whole Taste Washington, the biggest wine event in Washington State that you attended.
Well, and it's the nation's largest single region wine and food event, and it's been an expanding event over the years. This is the 18th annual event, and it was a lot of fun.
Oh, I bet. I didn't realize it was the largest in the nation.
Well, they call it wine and food event single region, so. I think maybe because California is so big, you know, they have Pinot festivals, they have Zinfandel festivals, they have all these different events. But because we're one region and we're not as large as California, we really kind of go gangbusters with it.
That's awesome.
I've been going since 2008, and I really enjoyed the pacing this year, you know, tremendously. I like the way it was laid out. And they've added additional events. There's dinner parties, there's functions. There's field trips out to farms and out to where they grow oysters and where they make cheese. So they've added more events that are food and production oriented and not just, you know, consumption of wine oriented. So it's really changed over the years and matured.
I want to talk about that after we talk about arsenic, but let's. I do want to ask you one thing. How much does it cost to attend that event?
So that's a great question. Which part of the event? So I also went to a seminar on Saturday, on the weekend of the event. And I attended a seminar on the Columbia River Gorge. So every event, so let's see, if we're just going to go wine tasting one day, the VIP tasting was from 1 to 5 p.m., $160. If you want a two-day pass to the VIP tasting, it was $205.
Oh, that's pretty cheap, actually, for what you get.
For general admission, which was from 2 to 5 p.m., so 1 hour less, it was $90 for one day. For two-day pass, it was $140. Both tremendous values. There was very little time to hit as many wines and wineries as you think you might want to. So tremendous value either way.
Okay, and Washington wines are not implicated in this arsenic lawsuit.
So this lawsuit was brought against...
And we're going to come back to the Taste of Washington again towards the end of the show, but we're going to cut through this real quick.
Yeah, the lawsuit is it's a California lawsuit against approximately a couple dozen producers, wine producers, that encompass around 83 different labels.
Yeah, so, and they're pretty much the low-cost labels. I thought that was interesting.
Well, the lawsuit is against volume producers. So think Two Buck Chuck. Ménage à trois, you know, kind of the entry-level consumer mass-produced wines. That's
the ones you see at Walmart. These are, either at Trader Joe's or you see them at Walmart.
Yeah, Trader Joe's is involved in the lawsuit because a lot of the wines they sell are these lower-end, low-cost wines. So, it is dealing with arsenic in wine, and arsenic is a poison. And
Napoleon Bonaparte was killed by arsenic?
Supposedly. I mean, they tested his hair, but they also used arsenic as a preservative. So they're not really sure if he was or wasn't poisoned by arsenic.
King George III, possibly.
So
And who knows how many other people.
Well, so when I think arsenic, I think murder mystery. We watch a lot of BBC murder mysteries at home. And,
right.
You know, rat poison would perhaps be the culprit where they are adding arsenic and trying to kill somebody in a short period of time. Mm-hmm. The kind of arsenic they're talking about in wine is the arsenic that you would be exposed to over your lifetime.
Right. Now, let's go back to the beginning of arson. Arsenic, not arson, arsenic, and talk about the difference at the very, before we even get into the levels in wine, let's just get into what it is. The FDA regards organic arsenic, that's the naturally occurring arsenic you get in your vegetation and soils and stuff, the naturally occurring as harmless, the FDA does.
So organic forms are rare in water. And they are the result of biological activity. Arsenic enters the food chain mainly through contaminated water and soil. And it is arsenic.
That's so inorganic, right?
Well, right. So arsenic, inorganic arsenic is a metalloid present usually at low concentrations in rock, soil, and natural groundwater.
Okay. I just want to make the point here that organic arsenic is not considered to be a carcinogen. It's considered safe by the FDA. And so that's like in shellfish, oysters, that kind of stuff. And so when we're talking about this lawsuit, they're talking about inorganic, and that's what you're talking about, the pollutions, the pesticides and that kind of thing.
Right. So, inorganic arsenic is naturally occurring, and it's in the soil. And because water's in the soil, water transports inorganic arsenic. And it's atomic number 33 on the periodic table of elements.
Oh, that's good to know. That'd be a trivia crack.
because inorganic arsenic moves via water and you need water to grow plants, plants will naturally absorb arsenic that's in the groundwater or that's in the soil and it moves through the water. Plants absorb the water, arsenic then ends up in the plants.
So name some other foods that we might find arsenic in.
So the main contributors to a dietary exposure over time of arsenic would be grains, processed products like wheat bread and rolls. Other contributors would be rice, milk, dairy products, and drinking water.
Okay. And I know apples were under investigation for a while, and that's one of the reasons why they put the 10 parts per billion in place, I think, was because of the apple issue, right?
So arsenic's, if you look at your fruits that have seeds, the seeds have high concentrations of arsenic, so which is why they tell you don't eat apple seeds, don't eat the pear seeds, don't eat any of the seeds in the fruit that you're eating because they contain higher concentrations of arsenic.
Did not know that.
Yeah.
I'm making a note to myself, don't eat seeds. I'm also a little worried about my well water because in studying arsenic, a lot of it is in well water, whereas the water you get out of the tap has been processed and there's much lower levels of arsenic in that. So now I feel like I need to get my well water tested. But go ahead.
So human activity can increase levels of arsenic in the environment, usually via industrial activity like mining, smelting of non-ferrous metals, burning of fossil fuels. Arsenic has historically been used as part of fertilizers, insecticides, herbicides, and in wood preservatives.
Okay. So now let's get to the wine issue. How did this whole lawsuit come about? In California, by the way, not Washington. This is all happening in California.
Yeah. So there is a gentleman who has a laboratory in Denver called Beverage Grades Laboratory. And they perform wine analysis. And so the gentleman that owns this laboratory analyzed 1,300 wines, I believe is the number, California wines. And based upon the analysis, he said that the amount of arsenic in the wine is greater than that allowed for water and that therefore there was a problem.
And what is it for water? 10 parts per billion, right?
So for water
in California, and that was only established since 2013 or something, that the 10 parts per billion came into effect.
So in the U.S., it is established at 10 parts per billion for water, arsenic for water.
All over the U.S., not just California?
From my reading, it's an FDA standard.
Okay.
And so 10 parts per billion based upon the consumption of 2 liters of water per day. So when we say that this is the safe level, that's a safe level over your lifetime. If you're drinking 2 liters of water every day for your entire life, then the arsenic should be, you know, no more than 10 parts per billion for water. Mm-hmm. For water. Mm-hmm. There is no standard for wine, for alcohol.
Right. So the suit's brought in because he's tested them, voluntarily tested 1,300 wines.
That's what I've read.
Okay. And he came out with some findings that I think it's White Zinfandel, the two-buck chuck, Charles Schwab, two-buck chuck, had about 50 parts per billion.
So a lot of the industry media reporting doesn't cite names or too many numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I also did read that two-buck chuck, White Zinfandel, according to the data that he released, was 3 times higher than 10 parts per billion. So I would assume that would be 30 parts per billion.
Okay.
Another wine, which was a Moscato, was rated 4 times higher. That would be 40 parts per billion. And then another wine producer was rated at 5 times. That would be 50 parts per billion.
Okay, but that wasn't the White Zinfandel from Charles Schwab.
So I didn't see the numbers for that one. The two-buck chuck, I didn't see those numbers.
And these numbers haven't even really been produced yet. There's a lot of talk, but the findings haven't actually been shared.
So my understanding is the only ones that have seen the data,
mm-hmm,
would be the law firm that's filing the suit.
Wow. But it's done a lot of harm. And so I know that, for instance, Trader Joe's has responded and said that they would never sell anything that they considered to be dangerous to their customers, and that the levels we're talking about are still well below what Canada and Europe have established as their highest maximum parts per billion, which are, 100 and 200, respectively,
so,
Canada 100, Europe 200?
Yeah, Trader Joe's said, concerns raised in your inquiry are serious and are being treated as such. We are investigating the matter with several of our wine-producing suppliers. And as far as the European and Canadian maximums for arsenic in wine, Canada has a standard of 100 parts per billion. And so that's that standard is still below what this guy found.
Mm-hmm.
So when he tested the wines and said there's arsenic in them, okay, yes, there's arsenic, but the levels of arsenic are still below the standards for Canada. And then Europe, like you said, it's higher.
And in Europe, 200. So
right,
we're well below that. But you're also saying that the water is based on the 2 liters per day. So that's a pretty big deal because you're not going to drink that much wine a day.
So the consensus in the wine industry was, if you're drinking 2 liters of wine a day, you have other issues that are more important than arsenic.
Right, right.
So,
now, why do you think, the reason why this occurs more often in cheap wine is just because they're mass produced?
So that's a good question. One of the other industry response, the wine that you're drinking, and if you drink a lot of wine, then maybe you need to look at other wines to drink.
Mm-hmm.
So the agricultural production, so there's this whole thing in the industry about organic wines, biodynamic wines, salmon safe wines. And the whole pitch about this is, if you are more careful with the use of pesticides and fertilizers, and if you approach a more natural way of farming, then your wines will be more natural, taste better, and be better for the consumer. And if you look at the Washington State wine industry, you know, a lot of the wines that we've tasted or that we drink on a regular basis are farmed in a more organic style these days, even if they're not certified organic. And perhaps the volume producers are using different methods and techniques to grow more fruit and make more wine. And then perhaps then you would see more arsenic expressed when you go and test and analyze the wine.
So how is this all shaking down in the wine industry then? Are they, this is helping the boutique winery, the organic wine vintner. Is it going to kill the the cheap wine off. I mean, I have to admit, none of these wines are wines I would drink that are on this list. And I have tasted them before in blind tastings, and they always came out the lowest. So they're just not there, but they are widely available, and they're mass-produced. So what's all happening? How's this shaking down?
So one of the requests of the lawsuit is to put on these bottles of wine contains arsenic. Just like when you look at every bottle of wine, it says contains sulfites,
mm-hmm.
which is another issue or non-issue. So the industry has in general responded as this is a non-issue, and this is just someone that's looking to perhaps work the system to pay for more or more lab analysis.
So that other people will take their wines in to get them tested.
Well, so if I had a lab, I would certainly not complain if I had more customers.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, everyone, the thing is, wines are tested and they get sent to analysis. I mean, they're tested for alcohol, for one. I mean, they're wines throughout the whole process are being tested. Every winery has a lab, or they send their wines to labs to be analyzed. I mean, that's just part of making wine, is to have either your own lab or to utilize lab services to test the wine.
And to export, they also have to have them tested.
Yeah, it's a food, so it has to be tested. It has to meet certain standards and criteria. Perhaps the issue of arsenic is not the issue of arsenic in wine, but more as an issue of arsenic in groundwater. And the issue of arsenic in groundwater would be of concern if you live near mines or if they're doing other sorts of industrial production, working with metals, or using chemicals that are patented and you don't know what kind of chemicals are pumping into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly I would be, you know, it's good to be concerned about what you're consuming. As far as, is it limited to wine? I mean, I've seen a lot of warnings lately about rice because they use a lot of water in production of rice, and rice has a higher concentration of arsenic. And if you eat a lot of rice, then maybe that is something that you would be concerned with, maybe mm-hmm. more so than wine that you drink.
I heard Brussels sprouts too, which I've never liked those anyway. So
no, we eat Brussels sprouts, but we don't eat them every day. And I certainly don't consume 2 liters worth when I sit down and eat. You know, I might have half a dozen Brussels sprouts, you know, once a month. I don't know. So,
well, was this brought up at all when you were at the Taste of Washington?
Oh no,
You talked about it. Okay. No, so the people in the wine industry probably don't consider it an issue. They think it's ridiculous.
So we all drink wine. We all enjoy drinking wine. We have a tendency to prefer higher quality wines as opposed to the less expensive wines. I participate in a number of wine surveys every month. And a lot of the wines they're asking me about are wines I don't drink. These are volume production wines made by a handful, you know, there we go, a couple dozen wineries. And they have, 83 labels? You know, you see all these wines with these pretty pictures and quirky names, and then you look at it, and it's California, and they're all produced by the same companies making the same wine with different labels on them. So, like tonight, I'm drinking an Alexander Nicole 2009 Merlot. It's a lovely wine. It's a Washington wine. It's a wine, you know, the winery and the vineyards are about 45 minutes from where I live. You know, I've been to the vineyards. I've met the winemaker many times, he and his wife. I've been drinking their wines for many years. They do a wonderful job. I have no issues with them and how they're growing their grapes and how they're producing their wine. So for me, when I see these wines they're talking about from these bulk producers, it doesn't mean anything to me.
No, me neither. Tonight I'm drinking a Paddock Creek Cellars wine called The Creek. Mm. And, you know, that's a pretty small boutique winery. It started out as a little restaurant. It was like the only 5-star restaurant west of Seattle. And it's out in the boonies. Remember that?
Right, right.
Paddock Creek. And it's just like this little hole-in-the-wall house, but it was always like a 5-star restaurant myth, you know. But it was there, and it just has a few tables, and you go in there and you sit in it, and you get this gourmet, fabulous food. It's been there forever. It's still there, right?
I think, I've never eaten there.
You've never eaten there? I mean, it's a crazy little place. It just, when you go in, it's just really shoddy looking, you know, just like an old cafe house, or a house, a kind of a combo of the two. And nothing fancy. And yet everybody just bragged about it being a 5-star restaurant. I still understand that, quite honestly, but I don't know what it takes to be a 5-star restaurant. But the food was fantastic. And that's, I guess, the only thing they're grading it on. But then they branched out and started making wine, and they have a tasting room here in Spokane, and then they have their tasting room down there in Dayton, I think it is.
Right.
Washington.
Driven by. We never stopped.
Wow.
Well,
gotta do that someday.
For this issue about arsenic and wine, on my side, I'm going to put up some links.
Okay,
Wine Spectator did a really good article on turning wine into water and creating fear out of nothing. And then the Wine Institute responded to this as well. And they represent wineries in California. And they have information on possible arsenic litigation. I'll throw up that link. And then I looked at the European Food Safety Authority. And they go into, they have, it's about a 50-page document on dietary exposure to inorganic arsenic. And it had way more information and scientific data than I could absorb. But it's a good resource if you're really curious about arsenic in food. They go into all kinds of foods and beverages, and they show you the levels of arsenic. And their main concern was arsenic exposure to children, mm-hmm. because they're more susceptible, and mostly via dairy product was their concern with children.
My question, I guess, would be, one, are they going to countersue? You know, the wine industry, will they countersue this group? And then two, is there any reason why someone would add it to their wine purposely? Would it have any benefit to the wine? Is there anything that it would do to help that wine stay preserved longer or anything like that?
I am not aware of any benefit. It also feels that the industry is not feeling malicious or vindictive, that it's just an issue that should be addressed and in a logical manner. And if there's an issue, then deal with it as if it's an issue. If it's not an issue, then it should be ignored, or at least educate people, which is, I think, what we're trying to do is to educate people by talking about it.
There was some wine that we were studying when we were going through our world wine tour, and there was a country that started adding some kind of a chemical into their wine to make it sweeter or something.
It was Austria.
It was Austria, yeah. What was that they were adding?
So it was a sweetener. It's a synthetic compound. And what I read is it was a glycol. It was a type of glycol. And what I read, it was misinterpreted what they were using, and that it was a real, very toxic substance. It was misreported as a super toxic substance. So that what they were using in Austria was to sweeten it, and in the amount that they were adding, it was not toxic.
Diethylene glycol. Yeah, that's what it was. Okay, so it wasn't arsenic.
No.
I'm just curious because since they added that to sweeten, I was wondering, is there anything that arsenic could do? But it sounds like this is just a problem with it being in the ground and getting into the grapes.
So, yes, or it's in the process, or it's in the processing method if they add a little water to it. So if you have a lot of alcohol, one way to reduce the alcohol is to add water.
Okay.
So that will thin out the alcohol. It would also explain perhaps the quality of the wine too, not just how it's made, but that if they are adding water to a higher alcohol wine to thin it out, that might reduce the complexity and the things that I look for wine usually, for a depth of flavor and character.
But no matter what we have discovered tonight, talking it over and doing our research, talking to other people, is that the arsenic that they have, and even in its highest proportions, which were not that high, we're still well below the standard that Canada and Europe have set. And if you were to go, you know, volume-wise with the 2 liter of water a day thing or whatever, you know, if just going by a glass a day, which is what, you know, 6 ounces or so that you're going to have, it doesn't touch that FDA requirement.
Yeah, the standard as far as exposure to arsenic is a lifetime exposure. And you are being exposed to arsenic when you eat food and when you drink water. And now when you drink wine, obviously. So it does seem like the numbers are small. Other parts of the world, or if you're living near where mining was done or smelting was done, perhaps there would be concerns about the groundwater there. So having your well water tested is probably not a bad idea. I read that some of the places in the world where they're worried about arsenic, legitimately worried about arsenic in groundwater, would be Bangladesh and parts of China.
Hmm.
So, you know, there are parts of the world where groundwater contamination via arsenic is a concern. In general, in the U.S., usually not an issue.
And do you know the symptoms of arsenic poisoning?
It depends what you mean by symptoms. So if you are being poisoned by a great aunt that wants your money, mm-hmm. and she's using rat poison or something like that, that's because arsenic is tough to get nowadays because they're not using it.
Oh, really?
It's been kind of weeded out of the whole, you know, getting access to. It's a classic poison from like a 1930s or 1940s murder mystery. Okay. Or if you read any Agatha Christie or watch those movies, which I do, they use arsenic sometimes. And so if you're getting that kind of arsenic poisoning, which is not what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. But I'm talking even the water, like if you had a well that was polluted or something and you had symptoms.
So severe gastroenteritis. Garlic odor and hypersalivation, a characteristic sequence of multi-organ failure with neurological symptoms within hours and cardiac features succeeded by respiratory distress, renal liver dysfunction, marrow suppression develops after a few days to weeks in survivors, as does alopecia and an ascending motor neuropathy. So,
In smaller amounts, I think it can cause nausea, fatigue, and all those things that people get all the time for other things.
Yes.
So how would you ever know it?
So for chronic arsenic poisoning, the main clinical features are skin lesions.
Hmm.
Typically start about 10 years after first exposures. Keratoses on the palms and soles are characteristic. Mies lines, which are transverse white lines on the fingernails. Hyperpigmentation, especially in the arms and upper chest. Also exfoliative dermatitis, alopecia, conjunctivitis, corneal ulceration. Anorexia, weight loss, abdominal pain, diarrhea, jaundice, hepatomegaly, and on and on. So, So one of the ways that arsenic poison is expressed over a lifetime could be cancer. So skin, lung, liver, bladder, kidney, larynx, and lymphoid system.
Mm-hmm. So it is good to get your well water tested. I'm probably going to do that. In fact, I think I might just have to drink wine all the time. At least I know that most of these wines are coming under 10 parts per billion. So actually, in some cases, these wines are probably better than water.
So, yeah, I guess it depends where you live.
Talking about the worst wine. I mean, there was only a few of those that went way over the 10 parts per billion.
And I read in somewhere they were talking about imported mineral water that had high levels of arsenic.
Oh, fun. So you think you're drinking something healthy and it's got arsenic in it?
Well, the best advice I read or heard, listened to, was an interview with Dr. Carl Winter, PhD, professor at University of California, UC Davis. He's a food toxicologist. And he said, have a diverse, varied diet. Don't eat a lot of just one thing. Eat lots of many different things. And that was the best advice. Just have a well-balanced with, fruits and veggies and water, and toss in some wine in there and some whole grains. Have a nice, varied, healthy diet. And that's the best thing that you can do.
That's always good advice, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and switch gears in. I think we have covered the arsenic and wine. As far as we're concerned, don't quote us and don't name us in any lawsuit, but you don't have anything to worry about. Drink lots of wine. In some cases, it's probably better than water. So let's switch gears to the Taste of Washington.
So, how about some facts? Participating wineries at Taste Washington. So once again, it is the nation's largest single region wine and food event. It's held in Seattle, Washington. And it is now a multi-day event, where before it was just like a weekend event that went for hours. And I recall the first time I went in 2008, having had way too much. Just, kid in the candy store. I was there as a volunteer for, I think it was like 7 hours. It was long. Mm-hmm. It was like an all-day thing, and it just wiped everyone out.
I bet. So how many hours was it this time?
So I was there from 1 to 5.
Oh, that's pretty short. But how long was it open, 1 to 5?
1 to 5.
Okay. I went 1 to 5.
I went with the media pass, so once they saw us in line, they got us out of line, and we got in straight away, and I just walked around and started snapping pictures. That's what I did. My first thing was, for the first hour, was to walk around and take pictures.
Nice.
So this year, there were 230 wineries. There were participating restaurants and food vendors, more than 65.
Wow.
And then they had a bunch of exhibits, which I, you know, for me, it was, at some point, it was just, it was too much. And I read that there were more than 50 exhibitors of all different types.
Wow.
So I did talk, I did kind of go past some of those exhibitors. As far as the number of bottles of wine that were being poured, more than 800.
Wow.
Total glasses used, more than 5,000.
Hmm.
They estimated the total number of wine pourers, you know, pouring,
mm-hmm.
at more than 200,000 pourers of wine.
Jeez.
And I would say that some of the pourers were friendly, generous, adequate, more than adequate.
That's a lot of wine for these producers to bring, though. I mean, if they have to give that much wine to people, and some of these are pretty low quantity yields.
Yes, I agree with you. And so I did ask, you know, how they felt the crowd was, how they were responding. Were people drinking? Were people talking? Were people tasting? And it was the wineries that I spoke to were very positive. They felt the crowds were very manageable. The flow was very good. People were receptive. They were asking questions. And so one of the wine bloggers and wine writers that I know in Seattle, his name's Jameson Fink.
Mm-hmm.
He suggested this year on one of his articles, pick a variety that you would like to know more about and just focus on that. So he suggested Cabernet Franc.
Uh-huh.
And when you looked at the directory for the wines and wineries, it will tell you which wineries are pouring which wines. So what he did is he went through and found all the wineries that were pouring Cabernet Franc.
Uh-huh.
And he said, if you want to know what Washington Cabernet Franc is like, just go to these wineries and just taste the Cabernet Franc. So a friend of mine, that's what she did.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bumped into her at a table where Cabernet Franc was being poured, and all she wanted was a taste of the Cabernet Franc. And she just focused on Cab Franc. And I thought that was a wonderful idea and a wonderful way to approach tasting.
And with that, when you have that many wineries represented, 230, how many of them were serving a Cabernet Franc?
I think there was 18. I don't have those notes.
That's
me.
It? Just 18?
I think it might have been 18. May have been more. I could be way off. I'd have to.
You might be way off. That would really surprise me. Only if there were only 18 out of 230. But, you know, crazier things have happened. I mean, that's doable. Only 18 wines to taste. That's pretty doable.
And you could actually drink them.
What did you do? What was your thought process through it?
So I had.
Drink it all.
So I had a list of wineries I wanted to, you know, not miss. But I also went with the intent of trying to focus on all the food vendors and restaurants. So my first goal was to go around and take pictures of everyone that had some sort of food that they were providing and serving and dishing up. And then to go back and then maybe taste some of them, but also look for wines to sample and taste, because I want to find new wineries and I want to connect with people I don't know. And then I also want to go back and perhaps connect with people that I haven't seen in a while.
So would you say this year you're more interested in the food aspect? I mean, clearly that seems to be where you're turning.
That was my attempt. Because in the past, they're secondary. I'll hit the wines and then there'll
right.
be some food, and I'll try to pair that food with some wine. That's what I used to do in the past. Now, I kind of sort of did that. I did hit and go around a lot of different food vendors to try to find out, you know, who are the restaurants that are popular, what kind of dishes do they think showcased, you know, their theme the best. So I walked around and did that. But what happened is at some point, somewhere perhaps after the 2 hour or 1.5 hour window, I bumped into J.J. Williams of Cayenne Vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with their wines?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So what they did this year is they had Taste the Vineyards, and they had 9 participating vineyards. And what they do is, so JJ was there of Kina Vineyards, and they make Kina wines.
Mm-hmm.
He was showcasing 8 different wines made with Kina fruit.
Oh. Okay.
So that was really cool, and
it
struck me as something I would like to try. So I stopped, and I visited with JJ. And he took me through these 8 different wines. 2 were Kiana. The others were not Kiana wines. And I was able to taste fruit that they grow.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it like kind of spun me around, and I actually drank those wines. I started off, I was going to spit, but the wines were oh so delicious that I I couldn't help myself. I looked around and nobody was spitting. I was the only one spitting. I was like, I feel kind of, you know, I kind of stood out a little bit by spitting.
Maybe miles and sideways.
But it was, for me, it was a wonderful opportunity to see what people were doing with their grapes growing around
now. Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, you couldn't usually, you had to buy a bottle. If you wanted to do that yourself, you'd have to go locate all those wines and buy a whole bottle. So you got to just sit there and do that.
Well, and some of the wines had just been released. One of the bottles had not been released yet. One of the bottles that was a Kona, it was a 2012 Old Block from the 1975 original planting, the very first vineyard that was planted on Red Mountain, their Cabernet Sauvignon. Mm-hmm. That's for wine club only. I have no idea what that wine costs. That's the other thing. So the other thing is when you're at Taste Washington, you're drinking wines, and often no one will tell you what these wines cost. It's not a topic of conversation. I have to ask, you know, what's the price point for this wine?
Oh,
what does this wine retail for? Because they don't tell you.
And you can't buy it there.
No, so I have no idea what any of these wines cost. I could tell you they were absolutely delicious.
Well, they probably like that. It's probably a better way to go through it. You know, I was reading about Cayuse. Is that how you pronounce it? Cayuse?
I think, Cayuse.
Have you ever had one of their wines?
I can't.
Every article I read about Washington wines, they mention them. That's the only biodynamic. There's a name for it when you are, it's not just vintner, but, you know, you do the groundwork, you do everything. He even uses horses to plow the fields, for goodness sakes. But he's 100% biodynamic or something, you know, it would take bioorganic or something. It takes it organic to a whole new level because everything is done regularly. He doesn't even use, by the way, man-made yeast. You know, we did that topic on yeast last month. He doesn't use those. He only uses organic yeast from the, I guess, the must of the grapes. I'm not sure. But anyway, a bottle of his wine, there's a waiting list to get his wine. First time I read about it was about 2 or 3 years ago in the Wall Street Journal, that Letty Teague's, you know, article.
Right.
And she mentioned it. She said it's one of the most beautiful wines she's ever had. And, of course, she's had every wine in the world.
Right.
And, but anyway, they have a waiting list. And I think when you get it, it's years long to get through this waiting list. You may never get through the waiting list, but you have to pretty much buy it on the secondary market. So I'm just curious if you've had Cayuse.
I guess I'm not in the loop.
But that being said, this weekend I did get to taste Walla Walla Vintner's first estate-grown wine.
Oh.
The Syrah.
So when JJ was pouring for me, he did pour the Walla Walla Vintner's 2012 Bello Rosso, which is 50% Sangiovese and 50% Cabernet Sauvignon.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that's a really good one.
So the Sangiovese comes from Kiona. The Cabernet Sauvignon comes from Balkis Vineyard. So it wasn't Kiona. My note said very drinkable. Yeah, it was a lovely wine.
Yeah, no, I love all of Walla Walla Vintner's wine, but they generally do source out from different vineyards. A few years ago, my family and I went down to do a little trip through Walla Walla, and we went out to the vineyard, and he took us out, one of the owners, and he was letting us eat grapes off the vines and everything. And it wasn't at that point, I think it was the first year they were going to bottle it. And so now they're just doing the release. Last year they released to the wine club only, and this year they released them to the public, and I had it. And it was different than anything they've ever done before because the grapes are different. Terroir is different. But it was, of course, fabulous, really good. And one of the owners there, I can't remember the names are escaping me right now, but he's also taught in that enology course that they have there in Walla Walla, and he's one of the founders of that and really has spread his love. And they were, I think, number 8 or 9. Nine, I think, maybe 8 in Walla Walla for wineries opened. I think Leonetti was number 1, right?
They made Walla Walla.
Yeah, so they were number 1, but Walla Walla Vintners, I think, was number 8.
Okay, so I've got the number for the Cabernet Francs from Taste Washington this year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on JamesonFink.com.
Okay.
He said that 26 Cabernet Francs.
26.
Yep, Walla Walla Vintners is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Seven Hills, Kitski Cellars, Gamache, Cougar Crest.
One thing about Walla Walla Vintners is that if you go into their tasting room, I think because of that educational background that they have, you know, teaching and founding the college there, and and being one of the first wineries in Washington State, mm-hmm. I think that they are, or certainly Walla Walla, I think that they are really intent upon sharing their love and passion with it. And they've also not gone for scores, although recently they've gone ahead and done some of the scores. But before that, they didn't do the scores. So they were still very approachable and not sold out like Cayuse.
Well, and then, you know, winemakers change too over time. If it's a family-owned, you know, it may be that the winemaker started the winery, or it could be a family and then they bring in winemakers. Mm-hmm. So sometimes there is a change over time, either as the winemaker maybe subtly changes their style or they learn more and more, or perhaps they even change out the winemaker.
Mm-hmm.
So it can change over time.
Very true. Walla Walla Vintners has kept the same owners all along. It's Gordy, and I can't remember the other owner's name. But anyway, they started as just a little wine shop, a little hobby shop, and it grew into what it has now. Probably a lot of people have. The Cayuse, the owner there, I think, is from France.
You know, if for some of the more difficult to obtain wines, I tend to shy away from them, and then I'll try to focus on some of the newer wineries. So one of the wineries I became a fan of a couple of years ago is Pomum Cellars in Woodinville.
What is it?
Pomum, P-O-M-U-M.
Pomum.
Mm-hmm. So the owner is Javier Alfonso. He's originally from Spain. He's Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And I did seek them out, and his wine's lovely, of course, which I expected them to be. But I asked, where's Javier? They said, oh, well, he's over at the other wine table. I go, what other wine table? She goes, oh, we have a new second label. So they have a new label called Idilico, I-D-I-L-I-C-O. And the label looks very Spanish because it has the Spanish bull profile on it,
mm-hmm.
like you see in a lot of Spanish wines. And he's doing some Spanish wines, basically wine grapes. Like he has a Graciano, and he has a Tempranillo. And so I visited with him for a little bit, and he was his second label is his kind of his new baby. He has an Albariño. So it's a new thing, and the wines are priced, I think, around $20 or a little lower.
Wow.
So they're less expensive than his other wines. Like his premium wines are 2 to 3 times that price.
Wow. That's pretty inexpensive. I'm surprised.
So I was very impressed by the wines he's doing with the second label, Idilico.
Oh, yeah. So as you went through there, what were you most impressed with?
So I'm a fan of Aniche Cellars. She's a small winery in the Columbia River Gorge, and she does some gorgeous stuff. And also Amavi out of Walla Walla. I popped in there and was very pleased by their wines too.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was Amavi. It's Amavi.
I don't know. I'm guessing. I've never – like Tomum Cellars, he sent me samples a couple of years ago, and I was blown away by his wines. But I've never visited his tasting room in Woodinville. So some of the wines and wineries, you know, that I try, I've just never had a chance to get to the wineries for.
How about Verjevin Lane? Are you familiar with their wines at all? That's a female vintner.
I've had them before. I don't think I've ever reviewed one.
Okay.
Lovely wines when I've been at tastings. I went to visit with Scott Southard of Southard Wines, but he was wandering the floor. He was one of the winemakers that was there but not there. He was, you know, out tasting. And he makes his wines in Sela, Washington, outside of Yakima.
Mm-hmm.
And his wines are very food-friendly, restrained wines. I guess there's another winery that was new to me, Somme des Parties. They're a Walla Walla winery. And I thought those were gorgeous wines. And I will try to make an effort to actually get out to their tasting room and try those wines because they were beautiful reds, just gorgeous. They have lovely Syrah, wonderful Cab. Just some really nice reds that I was unfamiliar with their wines.
So Leonetti wasn't there?
No, Leonetti wouldn't be there because all his wines, like Cayuse, are pre-sold.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no reason to pour wines you can't buy unless you buy them on the secondary market.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
His son has a new label, Figgins. And that was been out for a while. Those are in big demand, and I don't know if he was pouring this year.
You know, what's interesting to me is when we interviewed Anne-Marie Sellers, is it Anna?
So she was there. Anna was there.
Anna. And she bought a plot of land that is next to Leonetti's vineyard. they're really highly rated vineyard, she was telling us during that interview.
Right. And they're, you know, Walla Walla is a pretty small community.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, their wine, Leonetti and Amarese are really close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of on that back end of Walla Walla. They're not in the main downtown area for a tasting room. So, and all the Amarese wines are gorgeous as well. I didn't take any detailed notes. I just went through and took pictures of all the lovely wines, and everything was beautiful. In the past, you might have, I may have bumped into a wine or two that I didn't care for, but every single wine was phenomenal this year.
Well, that's Washington for you. Washington is, and you know, I talk to people and they tell me that Washington really isn't on the map in a lot of other places once they leave here. It's just not on the map. And they don't think about it. And when they do, and they see it on the wine list, it's one of these mass-produced wines from our state that I won't mention.
Right.
But so, and then they mark them up.
So I tell my industry friends, if you want to learn about Washington in the easiest way possible, you should come to Taste Washington, you know, end of March. Every year it's usually end of March. And it's your opportunity to explore and to go out and taste. And my recommendation has to be, if they're going to continue to do these vineyard tastings where you can go and taste wines made from grapes from a particular AVA or vineyard,
mm-hmm.
that is a wonderful way to just get a quick snapshot. And like JJ, he poured 8 wines. Every wine was absolutely gorgeous. All the fruit was from their vineyards on Red Mountain. Beautiful snapshot of Kiona, Ward Johnson, Sparkman Cellars, Walla Walla Vintners, Helioterra, which I didn't know. They're an Oregon winery, and they make a Washington wine, which was absolutely gorgeous. It was a Mubedra. Rasa, which is a Walla Walla winery. Native Sun, they're a local winery here. Gorgeous 2010 Cabernet Sauvignon. 100% Cabernet Sauvignon from Kiona's Red Mountain Vineyard. Blew me away. Beautiful wine. And then, if you make friendly with the winery, you know, JJ then told me that there was a winery around the corner that was pouring an undertable wine. Do you know what an undertable wine is?
No idea.
So
it's not a table wine, it's an undertable wine.
So the wineries have the wine that they're pouring, and then they often will have a secret bottle hidden, stashed away, only for special people or people in the know or a friend. And then they will have, it's called an undertable wine because it's under the table, it's hidden, and they don't tell you about it, and you have to know it's there to ask for it, or they might volunteer.
Weird.
So JJ told me that Charlie Eau Claire had a Petit Verdot under the table made from Kiona fruit. This is why JJ threw me. When I had this plan about wine and everything I was going to do, and then JJ said, you need to go over.
Go get these under the table wines. That sounds really good.
And Charlie Eau Claire's got a Petit Verdot made from our fruit. So the next thing I know, I'm over at talking to Charlie Eau Claire, and he's pouring me the Petit Verdot. He's giving me a look like, why did he tell you? And then other people came up and started talking to me, and then they go, oh, you need to go over there, and you need to try this. And then,
so if we go into a winery, should we ask them to get their, you know, give them a little wink, slip them a little 5 or 10, no, just kidding. But anyway, just say, hey, do you have some of that under-the-table wine anywhere?
So usually it's something special, and it would be for a wine connoisseur, and not every winery does it. But at a big event like Taste Washington, there will be a number of special wines or unreleased wines or a super, super limited production wine
mm-hmm.
that they're saving only for those special people. It could be a wine club member, just a good friend, or somebody that they liked, you know, during the conversation. And they go, oh, you should try this. It's something under the table.
I could say that kind of happened to us one time. So currently we are fairly popular. It was a winery we went into, I think it was over Bluff Cellars, actually. And the vintner is like 80 years old or something. In fact, I think he might be retiring pretty soon. But he's a cool, cool guy. And he just comes out and drinks with you. And pretty soon, if you talk enough and everything, he was pulling his special stash out of the back. And it was his reserved wines. And they're all numbered, like an art piece. I think I may have told you this before. So you're like 1 through 1,000. That's it. And they're all numbered. And he offered those to us. And we bought a bunch of them. Yeah, they're fantastic. He told us to put them away. He's like, put them away. Don't drink them. These are like to be kept for a while.
Oh, well, and that's good advice because some wines are just not ready to drink when they're bottled and sold, and they really need 2 or 3 years to come together and start to show off.
We didn't touch them, though. We drank them. Just kidding.
Now,
we drink 2. We still have, I think, 6, maybe 4. I don't know.
Taste Washington is all about Washington wine, and then the food to, you know, to enjoy with the wine. But there's also ciders are there, and Finn River Cider was there, and they're pouring several of their ciders, and I'm a fan. They're an Olympic Peninsula cidery, and they're an organic farm. So that was a treat. I made a point to stop at Finn River and try their ciders because they were gorgeous. And then one of the other cideries that I'm a fan of over on this side of the state, outside of Yakima in the Natchez area, is Tyotin Cider. And they have a new label. They redesigned. I think people have kind of found out who they are, and I think they've really gained in popularity. So for me, the ciders were a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. It's a nice contrast. How many of them were there?
So those are the two that stood out. And then one of the big sponsors was the Stella Artois, beer. So there's beer.
Oh, wow.
So Stella was there. They were one of the big vendors. And then they were also, they make that Cidre cider, the Cidre.
Okay.
So I know people were going up to their bar and getting really nice glass pours of beer and getting a nice glass pour of cider made by them as well.
Man, was there a place to stay around there? Because I'm not thinking anyone's going to be driving after that. There's been hopefully lots of hotels within walking distance.
I read that there were 11 participating downtown hotel packages.
Oh, so it's downtown?
Oh, so where is Taste Washington held at? It's held in
Seattle. Good question.
It's at CenturyLink Field Event Center.
Oh, CenturyLink.
So where the Seahawks play,
yes.
Right, you know, attached is this big, gigantic event center. So for me, I usually stay with my friend in Belltown, and I timed myself this year. It takes me 40 minutes to get there.
Jeez.
So for me, it's a very enjoyable walk past a lot of places I remember from my youth.
Oh, you walked?
Yeah, I walk. It's a 40-minute
walk. It's like a 40-minute drive.
Okay.
Wow. You are diehard.
So I enjoy the walk. 40-minute walk for me. It's very refreshing. Mm-hmm. It's urban. Lots of interesting people. Some you dodge. Some you don't. But the city is changing downtown, and I talked to a number of locals and friends. One of the things you'll notice today when you drive downtown is, I think it's on 3rd I noticed, one of the lanes has been removed for driving, and they put up barriers, and it's only for bicycles.
Oh, I've heard that. They're really making it bicycle friendly.
So they're making the city more bicycle friendly, and mm-hmm. There are some people that are trying to do what they do in London. So if you want to drive in downtown London, you have to pay a fee. You have to get a permit for different parts of the city. So you can't just go to London and drive through it. You actually have to pay a toll to drive through different parts of London.
Oh, wow.
And so there have been some people in Seattle that are talking about requiring a permit, a pass, or to have those cameras that automatically snap your picture on your plate, and then you'll get a bill in the mail if you drove through parts of downtown Seattle.
Oh, weird.
So that's been under discussion. The feeling I'm getting from people that live in Seattle or people that work downtown is that they don't want people driving their cars downtown. And my biggest complaint about Seattle downtown is parking. Parking is such a nightmare.
Well, there is none unless you're staying at a hotel.
So before I went before I went to Seattle, I told my son,
there's a few places.
I know exactly where I'm going to park when I go to one of the events I want to go to in downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, I said, but I wonder if it's still there because maybe it's a building. So when I went to Seattle this last time, I went down to First Avenue looking for the parking lot I used to park at. And it was gone because they have a building they're building on it.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So less parking.
You know, the other thing is you can stay over at any of the locations, Bainbridge or any of the locations, the little islands or inlets, or and take a ferry across, and it takes you right into downtown Seattle. So you could stay, and Bainbridge is a really nice little town, and lots of little places you could stay there, probably bed and breakfasts and things, and it's a very quaint little town. We would stay in Gig Harbor. But that still requires a drive because you have to drive to Bremerton and get on the ferry. But still, it does take you to downtown. And then you could sober up by the time you got over to Bremerton and then just do a 15-minute trip down to Gig Harbor.
Right, right. And actually, that's a great idea. I did spend one night in Bellevue. I went to a wine tasting where everybody brought a bottle of wine and we all hung out and drank wine and everybody brought food. And I was there for, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours and just chatting and meeting people. And that, for me, that was a lot of fun, this wine tasting they do once a month. And all featured wines that were being poured at Taste Washington.
Oh, wow. Well, it's an amazing event. I need to go.
Oh, yes. So you have not been to Taste Washington?
No. I have not been to it.
So I did go first in 2008, then I went in 10, I went 11, I went 12, and then I skipped 2 years, and I went this year.
Oh, you skipped 2 years. There's a time we were over there working, and that would have been the perfect time to go, but I didn't know it existed. Now I do, so I'm going to put it on my bucket list.
So what? One of the things that they've been adding are these seminars, and the seminars are no longer held at the venue where Taste is at. This year they had the seminars were at the Four Seasons, which is just a few blocks from Pioneer Square District.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've stayed in Pioneer Square.
The one I went to was the seminar was on the Columbia River Gorge AVA.
Okay.
And we had a bunch of different wines for tasting. We had 6 different wines that we could taste. The winemakers were there. We had a discussion on the climate of the Columbia Gorge AVA, how it overlaps Washington and Oregon. And what was interesting is they focused on the high altitude vineyards or alpine style vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
And so the wines that we tasted were not the wines I usually think of when I think Columbia River Gorge. So these were lower alcohol, higher acid wines.
Oh, cool. White?
So it was predominantly whites, although we did have some light-bodied reds, too. It was like 3 whites and 3 reds.
Well, what were the reds?
Memelousse. Do you know Memelousse?
No, I've never heard of that.
So they're from the Oregon side, and he had a Cab Franc.
Okay.
And then Sincline Cellars was there, and they had a 2012 Pinot Noir from the Celilo Vineyard, which is planted.
Okay, cool, yeah.
And then Analemma Pinot Noir. I wasn't familiar with them either. So those were, and they were not what I would call a Washington wine. They were very light-bodied wines. They were, and even the whites were. I mean, we had core sellers. Do you know them?
No, I've heard of Sincline. That's it.
Okay. It was an interesting blend. It was Pinot Gris Gewürztraminer.
Wow.
Fermented in concrete. That was really
cool. Yeah.
That was probably the favorite wine that was poured at that event. And then Dowsett. Do you know Dowsett? I didn't know that.
No, I don't know that either. Uh-uh.
They poured a Gewürztraminer. I think it was 100% Gewürztraminer. And it was you know Grandma, how she smells with her perfume?
Yeah.
Very rosy floral.
Yeah.
That's exactly what this wine smelled like. It smelled like,
oh my goodness,
hugging Grandma and getting that.
No way.
Yeah, that's what it smelled like. But it was a real pretty wine, very floral. And then Woodward Canyon, they poured their Chardonnay from the Celilo Vineyard. So they're not, you know, so Woodward Canyon is a Walla Walla winery.
Mm-hmm.
But they poured this crisp, really dry, low alcohol, high elevation Chardonnay that was gorgeous.
Very cool. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. Everybody needs to put it on their bucket list.
Yes.
So tonight's show's almost over. We're already being told that we have 90 seconds, so now it's probably 60. We have found out. I'm glad we found out because I was actually getting a little worried about the whole arsenic and wine thing. So
right.
I'm glad I researched it because, you know, any arsenic's too much arsenic in a lot of ways. But now we know there really wasn't. This is just so minuscule. You know, just several parts per billion. It's nothing.
Right. I wouldn't worry about it at this point.
No, it's a drop in the bucket.
And if you are worried, stop drinking the cheap stuff.
That's right. Just go to the expensive stuff and give up water. Just kidding. No, don't do that. Well, William, I don't know what we're going to do next month, but it'll be fun. Every third Thursday, join us here in the Wine Muse. And, you know, call us. 909-202-8606 is the number. It's also on the show page. We'd love to hear from you guys. Or drop by Wild for Washington Wine.
Please.
Well, William, enjoy your glass of wine, your bottle of wine tonight. I'll enjoy mine. Cheers.
Yeah, thank you. Cheers.
Thank you for joining us tonight on The Wine Muse. You can hear more of our shows at minstrelandmuse.com. And you can find us at William Pollard's blog at wildforwashingtonwine.com. Please join us again every third Thursday of the month, live here on BTR for another new show.